Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. It's the Alex Jones Show, the dread of tyrants everywhere. And then the War Room, Harrison Smith, 3 to 6 p.m., the War Room Live. Jay Dyer, expert on the New World Order, coming up. But this is a longer compilation. I won't have time to get into it all. In post, we upload this to X and Real Alex Jones on X and Rumble / The Alex Jones Show Live. We'll put the full compilation. But I hate the left getting to be, you know, grandstanding and have the high ground. But when you do have Israel dragging us into total war and expanding and doing all this and blowing up Christian settlements, you got to say stop it. But we have to understand that the left is not the answer to this as well. It's like if you got a heart problem, cancer is not the answer to the heart problem. Or if you got malnutrition, and the answer to that is not having, shooting yourself in the head. So here's part of the compilation. I'm going to come back with some key words as I introduce Jay Dyer, but here it is.
Anti-genocide candidates triumph in primaries after enduring targeting by pro-Israel forces. By Gen X Girl, 1994. Did you know most of the anti-genocide candidates who won primaries were people who were targeted by the Zionist machine? Most of the candidates who won Democratic primaries while opposing the genocide in Gaza share a striking history of personal and professional backlash tied to their activism. Outlets across the spectrum, from The Guardian and New York Times to Politico, Al Jazeera, The Forward, and Mother Jones, noted these victories as part of a progressive wave driven by outrage over Gaza. While some coverage in social media focused on smears involving the Democratic Socialists of America or unfounded fears of other ideologies, they overlooked a clear commonality. These candidates took firm stands against the genocide and U.S. military aid to Israel, and they faced protests, job losses, arrests, scrutiny, and other repercussions linked to opposing Israel's genocide in Gaza. When their lawmakers failed to uphold laws protecting free speech and banning weapons sales to human rights violators, these candidates chose to unseat them. As someone who has closely followed the pro-Israel persecution of anti-genocide student protesters and activists since October 2023, this comeback gives me great hope. Melat Kiroz won the June 30, 2026 Democratic primary for Colorado's 1st Congressional District in Deep Blue Denver, defeating long-serving incumbent Representative Diana DeGette. She has called for ending the genocide in Palestine and rejecting AIPAC-style funding. She was previously fired from a law firm role connected to her public criticism of law firms' responses to October 7, 2023, and their stances on Israel and Palestine. Adam Hamowy won the June 2, 2026, Democratic primary for New Jersey's 12th Congressional District. A former U.S. Army combat surgeon in Iraq who helped save Senator Tammy Duckworth's life, he volunteered as a trauma surgeon in Gaza in 2024 to 2025 treating injuries from the conflict and worked in disaster zones including Post 9/11 New York, Bosnia, Haiti, and Syria. After much frustration at the lack of interest from lawmakers to address the Gaza genocide, he ran for office. He has called for ending U.S. arms sales to Israel, and his primary victory in New Jersey makes him the only U.S. Congress member with firsthand experience of Israel's genocidal war in Gaza. Darieliza Avila Chevalier won the June 23, 2026 Democratic primary for New York's 13th Congressional District, defeating incumbent Representative Adriano Espaillat. She has been outspoken on Palestinian rights, participated in protests, and criticized Israel policy and AIPAC ties. She has a background as an activist who faced targeting for protesting the genocide in Gaza. She was at the heart of the pro-Israel persecution of student protesters to include unjustified deportation attempts. Claire Valdez won the June 23rd, 2026
All right, let's stop here.
Democratic primary.
Again, because we're live, but I'm going to put the whole report up. And I got another one, too, we'll put in post. But, sorry, I was eating during that. I hadn't eaten yesterday, trying to get a bite. Well, I'll come back and explain because I don't want to cut this short. But these are the Democrats, Socialists of America. These are communists. And they're Trojan horsing all their evil policies in, going, oh, we're against genocide. And they're a bunch of Islamicists, and it's dangerous as hell. But AIPAC is unable to really affect them because the Democratic Party's been taken over by this. And so now AIPAC's focusing on the Republican Party with its own brand of idiocy and evil. So we're stuck between a bunch of crazy warmongering Zionists and a bunch of communist Islamicists. I mean, this is bad, folks, real bad. Globalists are collapsing worldwide, but they're fighting back with tyranny, censorship, and more. And they have targeted my operation more than anybody else's. But that's okay. That means we're over the target. It means we're effective. And I couldn't have done any of this without you. All the success of my operation through the listeners, the viewers, your word of mouth, your support, and, of course, the great crew. And that's why I want to just thank you all as America approaches its 250th anniversary. We have to understand they're trying to demoralize us, trying to break our will. We can't let them do that. It's the globalists that are losing. We're actually winning. So, to celebrate America's 250th anniversary, we're launching the biggest sale in the history of thealexjonesstore.com. Ladies and gentlemen, buy one, get one free ultramethylene blue. Buy one, get one free bovine colostrum. Buy one, get one free Shilajit complex. So incredible. And up to 60% off on all the other supplements, 50% off on all the Patriot apparel, limited edition, 250th anniversary, and more. So take action now at thealexjonesstore.com and be the reason we stay on the air and celebrate our American Republic, the globalist hate.
The program leftists failed to silence. It's the Alex Jones Show.
I'm doing a special broadcast tomorrow at noon for several hours, commercial free or light. We'll take a few breaks. At the Alex Jones Network at alexjoneslive.com, on Rumble at rumble.com/The Alex Jones Show Live. And, of course, on X at Real Alex Jones and at AJN Live. That's just the initials, at AJN Live. So be sure and join us. I'm going to get heavily into America, what it stands for, Founding Fathers quotes, the even greater threats of tyranny, and really some of the very same tyrants we faced then facing now, what's left of the British Empire and the whole globalist NATO constellation, the Chi-Coms, Israel lobby trying to come in and take over. It'll be a big show tomorrow at noon live at alexjoneslive.com. Be sure and join us and tell everybody you know. And those you don't know, tune in because you're the Paul Revere's. You complete the chain reaction. Now, if you just joined us, I played the leftists, Democrats, socialists celebrating that they're winning all the primaries nationally, getting rid of the incumbent Democrats, and they are winning the local elections in the primaries for governor, state rep, state senator, county commissions, mayors, everything. And it's all, we're against Gaza genocide. We're against Israel. And just bing, 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 they win. But really, it's all about censorship and open borders and communism and rent control and just absolutely destroying the country. And the Democratic Party at the top and big money is financing this. Mondami, all of it. And so then in post, because we're out of time, because I want Jay Dyer to take over, I'll also play this report of just the Democrats vitriolically foaming at the mouth, we're going to get Israel. Now, again, I don't want to be run over by a dump truck or a Mack truck. I don't want to be run over by a city bus or by a cement truck. I want our country to run our country. I don't want a greater Israel. I don't want us drug into all these wars. I don't want the Strait of Hormuz closed. I don't want them primarying our people. But the Democrats are total commie New World Order now, with Soros and all the anti-Israel stuff in this dialectic and the universities and the big money. And then you got the Israel lobby, so-called right-wingers, whatever that means, one of the most liberal, gayest countries in the world, you know, into actual policies. But, oh, it's conservative and Christian values, Judeo-Christian and all this. Meanwhile, you got the atheist, secular Jews absolutely at war with the conservative Jews. It's all just a disaster. How is that our worldview? How is that our world focus? So I'll play this other insane compilation once it's been uploaded to X and once it's been uploaded to Rumble, because we're live right now, but later I'm going to cut it in because of time constraints. It's just a big deal. And then separately, all these videos in the U.S., Canada, the U.K., if a Christian preacher tries to speak, even a Speaker's Corner, they get arrested. If Jews try to speak, people are coming after them. In Canada, Jews can't go into a university or to a public event that the Islamists are running, and they're like, you evil Jew, F you, you old white piece of crap, we're going to kill all of you. Just remember, these people are frothing. So people then go, oh, well, let's then go along with whatever Israel says. And this Jewish professor's like, I'm not even in Israel. I'm Canadian. I'm not even for these wars. What do you mean? Well, you're wearing a yarmulke, you can't come in. And the police go, yeah, you're Jewish, you can't go to the university, even though everybody else is allowed in the open area. They're in the university outdoor commons. You got a yarmulke, you can't come in. I mean, this is so dangerous, folks. You're a preacher, Christian, you can't speak. This is tyranny, folks. So recognize all these different flavors of tyranny as we go into the fourth turning. You've got all these ideologies, all for censoring and all for control. Got the left saying censor everybody. You got the Israel First lobby saying censor everybody, and then attacking anybody that's even reasonable and says this isn't going to work. It's going to demonize America and Israel. It's going to fail. I'm right. I'm still bad. I don't want to fight with Israel. I don't want to fight with the Muslims. But you guys are sucking us into your world. Can I have my own world? Can I be America? Can I not be controlled by all these foreign interests? The Chi-Coms and the EU and the globalists and all the rest of it? Keir Starmer trying to control us. Thank God he's gone. It's about sovereignty. That's what America's about. Our own country. Not even isolationism, but not all these foreign entanglements. America first, baby. So, I'm going to hand the baton to Jay Dyer. Just remember, I can't do this alone. I can't do this and face down the globalists and the CIA and the New World Order and the Democratic Party and Bloomberg and all the rest of it without you. I need your word of mouth. I need your prayer. It's how we reach new people. AlexJonesLive.com is coordinates for all the audio and video feeds and special reports and articles and live shows and everything. It's such a powerful thing that we're able to get this out, and it's kryptonite to the bad guys. It's holy water and high noon and garlic to vampires, silver bullets to werewolves. It is the light of disinfectant to tyranny, so people are actually generally informed, as Thomas Jefferson said, so we can have liberty. So we're running the biggest sale in the history of the AlexJonesStore.com in 2 years. It's history. Buy one, get one free for ultramethylene blue, bovine colostrum, Shilajit complex. You have today, Saturday, and Sunday. It's a flash sale for America's birthday. Up to 60% off all the other supplements, 50% off all the apparel. That makes some of these break even or loss leaders. Because like an XXL costs way more than a small. We make money on a small 50% off, but not on an XXL. So great deals there at thealexjonesstore.com. And it's a fundraiser for our operations. The tyrants absolutely hate it. And then finally, give me an overhead shot of this. 2,000 of these came in from the Missouri Mint, pure silver. 3,000 more come in, I guess, next Friday, so like 7-8 days. We can show you actual up-close B-roll of these babies. They are awesome. But it is a limited edition, only 5,000 of these. On one side, it's the Jerusalem cross with 1776. United States of America says it's centennial, 250 years. On the other side, American Eagle, American flag. It says America 250. This is a fundraiser for the operation. These coins cost us $67 a piece to make. We're selling them for $117.17. So, again, that gets us whatever it is, $40 in to fund the operation. So this isn't like an investment in silver. If you want to buy it at wholesale, you do that at kepm.com/gold. This is a memento, a fundraiser, a keepsake for the operation, because only 5,000 have been made. I would imagine down the road you probably could sell it for more than you got it for, because once they're, I mean, a lot of the coins we put out like 9 different coins over the years. You see them sell for $300-$400, and people, you know, bought them for like 99 back when silver was 20. We could sell them for cheaper, but this costs us 68 to print them and make them and do it because of the silver cost. And it's been up and down, as you know. So get these now. It funds the operation. I can't do it without you. I thank you for your support, but it's a great memento. And we're fighting the globalists into the future. This 250 year mark is so important. And we're facing peril even greater. But people, to a great extent, have better tools than ever to fight tyranny. And so we've got a real fighting chance. We're winning a lot of battles, but not the war. Please support the broadcast. If you want to stop the next pandemic, want to stop the next war, want to expose all these foreign interests trying to control us, you got to back those that back you. It's the only way we can do it. This is your insurance policy against tyranny. The tyrants hate this broadcast more than anything else. So get incredible supplements that will change your life. Get incredible collectible coins, knives, the widest selection of Patriot apparel and more. The best deals and sales going ever, but only for 3 days. Doing a special show tomorrow noon, the regular Sunday show. 4 to 8 p.m. Be sure and join me then. But the great Jay Dyer, best-selling author, incredible researcher, who goes right to the globalist's own words and documents, Jay Dyer takes over now. It's up to you. The ball's in your court. I fired the bat signal, Paul Revere's. I need your word of mouth, your prayer, and your financial support. Any great products at thealexjonesstore.com. You are the answer to 1984. You are 1776. You are the resistance. It's up to you. It's free will. I ask you for your support in this fight if you choose this mission. Thank you. Jay Dyer. Unmute yourself, Jay.
As you know, I like to go to the sources. Thank you, Alex. I cover the topics that most people don't want to get into, particularly the global elite books themselves. And today we're going to do just that. In fact, We hear a lot about the Rothschilds. There's a lot of mythology. There's a lot of conspiracy theorizing. But what if we go to the authorized biographies or the approved biographies to see what they themselves say about themselves from their archives? So today we're going to be going through the Rothschilds, which is the official biography by Morton. This was approved by the family. They let Morton go and look at the archives. Morton himself is also a Jewish person, so he certainly has no desire to present them in a negative way. He doesn't appear to dislike them. He tries to give a thorough but accurate approach and a very readable, I guess you could say, almost Game of Thrones level analysis of the rise of the dynasty from the 1700s up until today. The book was published in 1962, so it does have some limitations in terms of time frame, but at least we can see from the 1700s into the 20th century how this family was able to gain such an immense amount of power, wealth, and influence to be one of the top global oligarchical families in the world, to become essentially the international financiers to the world. It's unknown exactly how much wealth they have because they have actually kept their assets private their entire history, which was, I guess, a very cunning and smart thing to do. So we want to understand the reality. We don't want to fall into too much theorizing. We want to see what is admitted, because that's a much more powerful, I think, weapon to fight this kind of stuff when we understand what their actual real relations were to the various powers of Europe, who they really were able to influence, what the battles for them actually were. And I think we're going to notice it's probably not everything that you think. There's actually quite a bit of their history that most people don't know about. So I was actually really surprised to read this, but I thought it would be boring. A lot of biographies are kind of boring. This was anything but that. It was literally like the reality of Game of Thrones. Rothschild family, in the introduction, according to Morton, they were successful because they actually had a plan. They planned not for the immediate, but for generational future dominance. And so that's a key element. Most of us don't think about planning generations ahead. We think about, how are we going to get this guy in, elect him, and he'll change and fix everything. No. In order to bring the Overton window back to sanity, to get it back to a more healthy position, it's going to take probably generations to save the West and to save our country. They're so far down the toilet. Now, some of the techniques, though, we probably don't want to engage in all their techniques, because Morton notes that they were very closely adhering to the principle of marrying within the family. And sometimes that's a little too close, which can produce a little bit of a slow boy here and there. So we might not want to be engaging in everything that they engage in. But some of these principles, I think, are going to be very relevant to understanding how to work in this world, obviously without engaging in degrees of, you know, serious sin or vice. We don't want to promote usury, for example. I would argue we don't. But otherwise, we do want to look at the techniques, the tactics, and understand the vantage point. Not all from an evil perspective either, because we have to understand these are also human beings. They're people. They do have a very, I would say, cult-like attitude in terms of the religion. I think rabbinic Judaism has a tendency to be very cult-like. And so it doesn't free people in the way that Christ can actually give people freedom. So they're actually bound up and enslaved to a very, if you look at the way Jesus, for example, in Matthew 23, he talks about the Pharisees. That's the rabbinic tradition of his day. And that's what really codifies into the Talmud and all these documents that we've heard about for so many years. And it's very legalistic. It's very binding in terms of sort of absurd laws. And it's that way on purpose, because absurd laws, I think that many people are rules within religions. They don't, it's not that they're purposeless. People assume that, well, this is stupid. They don't have any purpose. Why would you do that? They're pointless. Actually, absurd laws are on purpose in terms of cunning elites to ensure that you listen, that you are obedient. If you read 1984, O'Brien gives Winston all kinds of absurd things that he's supposed to adhere to and believe and say. And that's actually to make you compliant, to ensure that you don't rest on your thinking. You rest on the cult's structure. The Rothschild family had a another series of strategic plans and strategies that also helped to be effective, namely the idea that the sons, and Meyer Amschel Rothschild had five sons that he sent out to different countries in Europe to set up banking houses, banking empires. This is also solidified in terms of the past talks that we've done on Carol Quigley. Carol Quigley has several chapters on the history of France, and he calls it the Paribas system. That's the Rothschild banking system that's set up throughout Europe. But Meyer got the idea that he would send out the five sons and marry them only to very wealthy Jewish women. But the daughters, he had a better idea. He said, they can marry wealthy Gentile Catholics, and that way we can solidify the power structure, not just amongst elite Jewish banking houses or whatever, but also amongst elite Catholic and even sometimes Protestant men who were married to the daughters. He also got the idea that if he had sons that were a little more on the liberal side of their ideology, he would send them to the more liberal countries in Europe. And if he had sons or daughters that were more on the conservative side, he would send them into the conservative countries. And so this, again, is all in the biography. So this is understanding left-right dialectics and understanding how to manage those. And that actually comes up multiple times in the text, that they were kind of above the immediate political crises, the immediate European warfare squabbles, this dictator versus this prince or whatever. They were above all of that. And they were typically riding the wave of investment. And that's very important because it's the same with Epstein. If you remember the Epstein emails, Jeffrey Epstein is talking to Arianna Rothschild and he says, we're going to ride this wave when there's crisis over here in Somaliland. We're going to ride this wave in the Greek debt crisis, the European banking crisis. We can profit from all of these waves by moving the money to where it will be affected. Everybody knows probably the famous story of Waterloo, that famous story where they had advanced intelligence on what happened at Waterloo and the defeat of Napoleon, and they were able to leak a fake story. And Nathan Rothschild in England, the London stock market crashes, they buy it up, and then it comes back. He also started dumping stock, too, to give the impression that he really was a believer in this false intel that had come about the war. And so they figured out very early on that you could utilize advanced intelligence to move your money around. And that's how they still operate to this day, given Jeffrey Epstein's emails with Arianna Rothschild. And remember, Epstein said, I represent the Rothschilds. He said this to Peter Thiel. He said this to many, many people. And so the other thing they did was create many, many corporations, many, many fronts, many, many cutouts such that nobody knew what the holdings were of the Rothschilds. And this was first an issue when Meyer was going to pass away. And when he was drawing up the will for his sons and daughters, he decided that the best way to do this was to tell them who would get what things very broadly. That way, no one could assess exactly what the assets and holdings were. And it was also, it was thus divided amongst the family. And then it was even harder to track because you don't know which Rothschild owns which assets. And over time, again, this is all kept very secret. But they also expanded into a lot of different industries. So they didn't just stay with banking. Even when by the 1800s, they become the biggest banking house throughout Europe, just one of the houses, whether it was in France or whether it was in London, other places, it was estimated in the 1800s that one of the Rothschild banks would have $500 million in 1800s money. And if you adjust for inflation, that's tens of billions of dollars in today's money. So again, throughout Europe, they had vast amounts of money, especially for the 1800s, even to the point where they were as wealthy or more wealthy than many princes throughout Europe. They became the holders and secret owners of many corporations, many companies. They moved into railroads. They moved into wine. They moved into chocolates, being chocolatiers. They had all kinds of businesses. And they also figured out that they could set up secret foundations and secret things that were not public. So that's, again, why it's so hard to know exactly in today's money, like what it's worth. You could think perhaps as something comparable, and I'm sure the Vatican probably has more asset wealth because of, you know, how could you put a value on, you know, thousands of cathedrals and basilicas throughout the world? They're all, you know, vastly worth an immense amount of money. You probably couldn't put a value on it. And the Vatican Bank, of course, we don't know what the Vatican banking assets are. It's private, secret banking. The Rothschilds are the exact same structure. And in fact, in the 1820s and 1830s, the Rothschilds begin to give loans to the papacy. I think it was 1832. Carl Rothschild begins to loan money to Gregory the 16th, and the papacy eventually becomes a vast debtor to the Rothschilds, and this eventually ends the Papal States. So if you wonder why the papacy eventually lost its political power, geopolitical power, and I'm not a fan of the papacy, I'm just telling you the history, that's actually covered in several chapters in the book. And that's because of Rothschild loans. There were many, many millions and millions of dollars of lira loaned to the Vatican. And the Rothschilds became the Vatican bankers in the 1830s. And as we said, so beginning in Frankfurt, Germany in the late 1700s, the family sends out five sons to the countries of Europe, to the key nations of Europe, Italy, England, France, so I think perhaps Spain. I forget all the exact details of it, but I'm going from memory. If you, are we at a break? Can you guys hear me? Okay, well, you went to a, it looked like you were going to a, are you just advertising at Alex's broadcast? Okay. Anyway, so the Rothschilds began in what we call the ghetto in the sense of it being a district where Jews were allowed to live. They were limited in terms of the state laws, in terms of how many marriages they could have every year, how many businesses they could have in Frankfurt, Germany in the 1700s. And Meyer began his business by getting the idea that he could collect numismatics and coins. And then because many princes and emperors and kings, et cetera, were very interested in coins and coinage, he could get a way into kind of making elite friends. And this was actually worked very well. He got to be friends with the Prince of Austria's financier, a guy named Buderhaus. They became really close. And this eventually led to him making loans to some heads of state. And that began a small banking house out of their small, what was called a ghetto. And they moved from a house that had a red shield on the front. This was not actually their name. It was just a house that had an old nobility emblem already on the house. And they just took the name Red Shield or Rothschild. And then eventually they moved to the nicest house in the Jewish ghetto known as the Green Shield. While at these places, they were able to build a small sort of banking empire where they were doing small loans, but Meyer had a bigger ambition to loan money to heads of state. And eventually this worked fabulously well. It was not too long before they'd actually established their own bank. And they had gotten to a point where they were loaning out extensively to other heads of state throughout Europe. And this, again, solidified Meyer's plan to send his sons into other nations in Europe. And they would basically repeat the strategy. Now, what's fascinating is that eventually in places like France, where they first gain an immense amount of power, and Quigley says the exact same thing in his chapter on the Paribas system, in France is where they decide that they have a strategy to get to the next level, to become the biggest international clearinghouse, setting the standards for the globe in the 1800s, and this is where they accumulate immense amounts of wealth. We'll get to that just in a second, but it's very clear within the early passages in the book that it is based on the Talmudic principles that Meyer followed. So don't go anywhere. This is the History of the Rothschilds on the Alex Jones Show.
Celebrate America's 250th birthday. The biggest sale in the history of the AlexJonesStore.com is live right now, but only for 3 days. I was 2 years old in 1976 when America celebrated its 200th anniversary. Well, I'm 52 now, and it's the 250th. No republic, no empire, no nation has ever survived more than 250 years. But America has to survive. The idea of America, private property, the right to lead your own life, to follow your own religion or not, so many things that this country enshrined that no other nation had became the model of the world. That's why the left, why BlackRock, why the globalists, why the WEF, why the UN openly want to discredit it. The elites don't like the idea of America because it allows the little people to have meritocracy and develop their own wealth and their own independence. The globalists want neo-feudalism. They want serfdom. They want a great reset to control us. So they've been trying to undermine this country, demonize this country, and blame all the problems in the world on the freedom of America and the West and Christianity and white people. But it's not working. The world is awakening to the Great Reset, and we are in the Great Awakening. That's why it's so important on our 250th anniversary that we remember what made America great and that we continue those values on in the face of tyranny. Because the ideas we're promoting work and are pro-human, are dynamic, and unleash the incredible competition of the human spirit and meritocracy. If we don't stand up for not just 1776 here in the U.S., but worldwide, then we allow the globalists, the megabanks, with their transhumanist, death cult, depopulation agenda to come in and sell their lie of collectivism, universal basic incomes, cashless society, control grids, the social credit scores, and the entire system of dehumanization that they're establishing. We are literally facing freedom or slavery. It's a choice we must take. So to celebrate this 250th anniversary, we have the biggest sale in the history of the AlexJonesStore.com. 50% off on all of the incredible Patriot apparel, the widest selection, some of the best designs in the world. What an adventure to wear this apparel and meet like-minded people and spread the word. And then most importantly, the very best game-changing five-star supplements on the planet. Up to 60% off, and all the best sellers are buy one, get one free. This Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, it's a flash sale. Ultramethylene Blue, the best on the market, buy one, get one free. Bovine Colostrum, the best, highest rate on the market, buy one, get one free. Shilajit Complex, that has all these natural peptides and boost your testosterone and more, buy one, get one free. As I said, up to 60% off on all the other supplements. The lowest is 40, the highest is 60. These are insanely good. All you've got to do is try them. We have over a 90% reorder rate at thealexjonesstore.com. And anyone who's shopping on the site should be a VIP. Cancel anytime. It's $30 a month. Instantly when you're charged, $40 is put in your account to spend on the site. You make $10, special deals, special offers, and sales on top of the sales, making a bunch of stuff loss leaders if you're a VIP. So become a VIP, commit to the American Republic in the year 2026. Help keep the broadcast on the air so we can expand the Alex Jones Network. It's a win-win. So to celebrate America and to stand against the globalist death cult, please support your own future and my future, our collective future together, by individual action at thealexjonesstore.com. Happy birthday, America. I salute all of our founders, our veterans, and all the patriots out there. God bless you all.
Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle, AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance. Live from Austin, Texas, you're listening to The Alex Jones Show.
Welcome, ready to the fourth hour of The Alex Jones Show. I'm your guest host, Jay Dyer, and a thank you to Alex for allowing me to be here. And just over the years, being such a good, positive, open, supportive person, he's helped me out a lot. I have nothing but positive things to say about Alex. He's a great guy. Met him in person many times. And I also want to note that on that note, we just did one of the biggest podcasts out there in the world that will be dropping very soon. So look for that Monday the 13th. If you're not a follower of mine on X or on YouTube, most of my material is in the, both of those places. I'm on Rumble and other places as well, but be looking for that Monday the 13th. We covered everything. We went through religion. We went through espionage. We went through geopolitics. We got into transhumanism, satanic cults, Hollywood, imagery, magic, all of that in what will probably be to date one of my biggest interviews so far. So be looking for that. And, I don't think ultimately that would have come about had Alex not, you know, been such a supportive honest, positive person over the years in terms of media operations and, you know, really being loyal and faithful to people who are loyal and faithful to him. I think people overlook a lot of Alex's really missed good qualities. So go to the Alex Jones store and be sure and get those products. Be looking for his special 4th of July broadcast tomorrow. That begins at 10 a.m. and goes until 1 p.m. Central tomorrow on 4th of July. And we're talking about the history of this famed family, the Rothschild, this dynasty that has eventually achieved, you could say in a way, kind of world domination. I don't think they control everything in the world, but they do control a lot, and they've had a huge amount of influence, especially in European and perhaps even American history, depending upon the degree to which various other banking houses are also perhaps linked to the Rothschild banking interests, entities like JP Morgan Chase and others. The Rothschilds and the Rockefellers, for example, some years back joined their fortunes in a famous, huge mainstream news story maybe about 10 years ago. You can still find that online. So these oligarchical elite have at times made these big, huge alliances. And we saw that Meyer Amschel had a lot of success precisely because he sent his sons and daughters out to make those types of alliances to build wealth and power. And the principles that he used, according to the Morton biography, were actually the Talmudic principles. In fact, Meyer was an avid daily reader of the Talmud and would apply these principles to business, to, you know, dealing with the Goyim or the Gentiles or whoever. And that's not conspiracy theory. That's just fact and history. That's in any of these authorized mainline texts. And eventually, as we said, by the late 1700s, early 1800s, they had established an international banking intelligence network. That's what most people don't understand, is that this is not just making money. It's also a family. And it's very similar to the way that if you watch The Sopranos or if you watch any gangster movie, they speak of the family as the most important thing, right? Tony Soprano, he's like telling Christopher, it's the family, Christopher, right? And Christopher and Polly Walnut, so they're submitted to him as the patriarch of a family. But in many cases, they're not actually blood relatives. They're just Sicilian. But in this case, the family was literally one degree of relation away, right? Brothers and sisters, et cetera. And that formed a much tighter bond. And also having the same fairly serious Orthodox Judaism as their religion as well, that, I think, created a perfect catalyst for an in-group sort of elitist presence that could overcome a lot of the obstacles that other people didn't think about, especially in terms of generational thinking. Now, Catholicism in Europe at that time also thought generationally, and perhaps many of the Protestants did as well. But nowadays, we don't really think that way. We think so in terms of immediate fulfillment that we just have lost this idea that a lot of battles, a lot of conquests, especially when it comes to culture war, idea, et cetera, civilizational battles, they're fought in the centuries and in the millennia. They're not hashed out with one goober being elected and tossed out with another goober being elected 4 years later. And the Rothschilds understood, especially with the chaos of European politics and battles, that they weren't really concerned with this or that event. They were concerned about 2, 3, 4 generations down the road. And everything they did was, quote, for the family, planned generationally. And that's why they were so successful. And they didn't get caught up in this prince versus that prince or whatever. They were able to establish an international network of intelligence, and it's explicitly called that, that had its own language, its own codes and ciphers based around a combination of German, Yiddish, and Hebrew. Thus, most European heads of state or spies or whatever, they were not able to decode these communiques and this information. And most of this information actually just had to deal with advanced knowledge on where to move money, especially in terms of investing. So if the Rothschilds had got wind of a battle and the loss or the victory, that tells you where to move or put the money. And it's no different today. That's actually what a lot of espionage and intelligence stuff today is about. It's not all the James Bond type stuff. That's a very small part of it. They saw no ideologies. They just saw stepping stones to investment. And so they ended up eventually becoming so powerful by the 1800s, mid-1800s, that they had to encounter and deal with heads of state. They had to deal with Napoleon. There was a huge conflict between the ideas of Napoleon post-French Revolution, the people that were funding and backing him, a rival banking elite and banking house, versus the Rothschilds and their approach to how society and culture would be run and funded. But again, I want to note that modern espionage comes out of banking. It's not coming out of like military warfare. The Rothschilds created, for example, one case, a coach, and the coach had a false bottom. This is a stagecoach in the bottom, where they would hide the secret letters that were all written in a secret language that was a jumble of Hebrew, Yiddish, and German. It was their own code system of pseudonyms. They could thus then keep any information secret, even if they found the secret box where they were hiding the communiques. But it didn't really end up working because eventually the first great international clearinghouse in 1815 was set up by the Rothschilds in London. And so they ran actually the international clearinghouse for the Bank of England. And this would begin to help set up international gold standards and so forth for international banking. The Waterloo intelligence event was a massive treasure scoop that gamed the market through an engineer panic. As we said, Nathan Rothschild was able to leak information that was false and then dump stock, giving the impression that it was about to crash. London stock market crashed. Then you buy it all up as pennies on the dollar. And this type of a rug pull or whale manipulation type of thing that we see in crypto and markets today, no different. It's been going on since the very beginning. Look up a Wyckoff distribution. It's the same situation in terms of stock investing. They had a mafia view of the family and commitment to the family, as we said. When they would marry their sons or their daughters off to elite families, they would then combine the empires and the estates. Eventually, they were able, through a lot of money and influence, to achieve minor nobility status in Austria. Thus, they were called the Von Rothschilds. Von is a name that's given when you're a minor nobility. By the 1820s, they became barons in various countries. Particularly, they began to have more and more success in England. And they were eventually the gold brokers to the Bank of England and to the Queen, to the Crown. So they were vastly wealthy, vastly successful. And they also sent out spies all throughout Europe. They had their own private spy network. So espionage wasn't invented by the Rothschilds, but modern espionage and corporate espionage was, because they were a private banking house that realized they needed to keep proprietary information secret. They didn't want any of their advanced intelligence on investing getting out. And so, as we said, they had their code system, but they also had their own secret agents and spies that they sent out into Europe to engage in their own espionage activities outside of anything to do with the existing state or head of state. They had, as we said, about $500 million in the mid-1800s in both France and other banking houses, which is valued at 60, 80, hundreds of billions of dollars in today's money. And after every battle and every conflict, they would, quote, ride the wave. They had both conservative and liberal sons, meaning that they were not concerned with basic bitch dialectics left and right. They've been always above that. And we've got to get above that stuff, because everybody in America still falls into this control structure of basic bitch, lib. And really in America, everyone's a liberal. The whole classical liberal ethos is liberalism. And so everybody's just a form of liberalism, one flavor of it, whether it's GOP or Democrat. But now we're just slipping over into full-on socialism, communism, Marxism, via the probably coming dominance of the left, the tech left, and others. Napoleon I was one of the first to challenge the Rothschilds. And I'm not saying that this makes Napoleon good. These are just rival weirdos. Right? Napoleon's obviously this weirdo. But he did enter into conflict because, as many socialist heads of state, dictators, kings, as they eventually learn, I need money. I'm going to have to be indebted to some foreign head of state or some banker, because kings need money. That's how they fund wars. This was even in Game of Thrones, right? They had like one of the cities in Game of Thrones, or one of the thrones was the bankers. So Napoleon I, when he lost, and he did lose in this battle to a degree in his battle with the Rothschilds, his nephew, Napoleon III, also lost to the Rothschilds. However, Napoleon III and his backers actually presented the first significant challenge to the Rothschilds. And this would make a great movie. This chapter was fascinating because this whole chapter is about this guy named Perret, who was a former employee of the Rothschild banking house, who also was Jewish. So it's not an anti-Semitic issue. He was just a rival lower level employee who stole something like $1 million francs or something in 1800s money. And he went off to found his own mini banking structure, which in itself would not have been a big deal. However, he found other huge big player opponents of the Rothschilds. One of these characters was a guy named Achille Fould, a French guy, a French banking elite, who was the opponent of the Rothschilds. And so Perret united himself with Achille and he said, look, I've been with these guys and their family. I know everything about their secrets and their tricks and their tactics. So what we'll do is we will mimic all of their tactics. We will then rival them and then we'll put an end to these Rothschilds. Again, this has nothing to do with really with ethnicity because Perret was also Jewish. It was just really power and money in this battle. They became the financial backers of Napoleon III. And they set up, which is kind of an interesting, I didn't know this actually went back this far, but they came up with this idea of employee-owned stocks. And so what their company would do, and it was called Credit Mobilier, was any company that took out a loan, because they had a tendency to favor socialism with Napoleon and Napoleon III, they were kind of socialist, but they also wanted this sort of dictator figure like a Napoleon, right? They came up with this idea to have anyone that took out a loan from the bank could also be a part owner in the shares of the bank stock, right? And that tended to work pretty good. It was kind of, I'm not saying socialism was going to say, this was kind of successful for a while in building up a resistance of a state-connected bank to challenge the private banking house of the Rothschilds. Now, the Rothschilds also did loan out to heads of state, so wasn't technically not to do with the state, but this was more of an open socialist state bank of Credit Mobilier intended to raise up a sort of Napoleon style figure. And that could perhaps challenge the private rising capitalist banking structure of the Rothschilds. Morton also notes, by the way, that the Rothschilds represent the end of European feudalism. They're really the key emblematic archetype of the transition from the feudal lords to capitalism, to the modern capitalist structure. So they really embody the idea of Homo economicus, right? Transitioning out of the idea of the feudal man and knights and lords and all that, Downton Abbey, Lord Grantham, transitioning into the idea of banking elites, right? No longer do cities have at the center of the city a giant cathedral. The biggest thing in the center of the city is a giant bank, right? All of our cities now are structured around gigantic banks as the middle, most important functioning of the city. That's the most emblematic picture you could give of classical liberalism and the idea of neoliberal economic theory. Neoliberal means classical liberal. That's what Ricardo, that's what Adam Smith, that's what laissez-faire is. That's called neoliberal economic theory. It's not just Hillary Clinton. It's actually classical liberalism is neoliberalism. It's money and money transaction is the most important factor in human society. In fact, Immanuel Kant wrote a whole essay on when we have global capitalism, world wars will go away. He actually thought this. He said, because what will happen is all the governments will favor trade over war, and thus we'll have an international global governance based on capitalism. I mean, that was pretty naive, but that was what Kant thought in his famous treatise on world government. But he's really just working within the structure of, John Locke, Adam Smith, David Ricardo, the various capitalist figures coming out of the feudal period. The Rothschilds represent, as the greatest archetype, that transition. Nowadays, we're transitioning into something beyond that, which is a sort of technocratic socialism, which also has had quite a bit of Rothschild support over the years as well. So we have to think about this as not committed to an ideology. In fact, the biography even says they're not committed to some specific ideology. They're committed to, first and foremost, power for the family. And the family can be above the ideologies and use them like chess pieces on the chessboard, the way that Zbigniew Brzezinski talks about in his book. So they were able eventually to purchase and influence their way up to not just being lords and barons, but also in England, as parliamentary, quote, democracy gained in popularity and prominence, they were eventually elected to the lower house and then eventually elected to the upper house and became lords in England as well, which was the first time that a Jewish person, at least as far as I understood this, had ever gotten to those positions. There's also a fascinating chapter on Disraeli, that Disraeli was 100% a Rothschild operative. That's actually what Carol Quigley argues in his book, Tragedy and Hope, as well. The Morton book says, yes. And the whole operation to take the Suez Canal was precisely for the Rothschilds. But to do this for the British Empire, that's the thing that got Queen Victoria to allow one of the Rothschilds to become a lord. So Rothschild did this for the queen, but he did it so that he become a lord, because prior to that, Queen Victoria said, I don't want any Jews being, in the House of Lords. And then Lord Rothschild said, well, what if I get you the Suez Canal through Disraeli? Okay, now you can be a lord. So the financial lordship and overlord structure that then was set up all throughout Europe as a kind of an octopus spider's web network was so successful and so interlinked through all the things that we said, they were able eventually to essentially take over the Italian peninsula. Not all of Italy, but they took over the Italian peninsula. They had that in their pocket. They then put the papacy into great amounts of debt in multiple series of loans beginning in the 1830s, even up until pretty late. I forget the last time there was a Rothschild papal loan, but this is all facts. This is all right here in the history texts. So this is how they built their empire. This is how they built a superstructure. And to go back to that challenge that we said with Credit Mobilier and Perret, together with Achille Fould, they had this partnership that was actually getting pretty successful. And they actually started winning a couple battles with the Rothschilds in terms of taking over certain areas and foisting their businesses out, getting them out of the country in certain areas. But the reason they were not able ultimately to succeed was because the Rothschilds were perceptive enough, number one, to figure out that, okay, this company-owned approach to stocks and banking is kind of having some success. So they set up their version of it. So what these guys thought would be a first rival competition of company-owned stocks and whatnot, the Rothschilds set up their version of it. It did very well. And then eventually they bought off their number one enemy, Achille Fould, and they bought off Napoleon III. And that left Perret, their chief undermining former employee, alone. Eventually, he was arrested for the original million francs that he stole from the Rothschilds, and he ended up basically broke as Credit Mobilier stocks collapsed. So the Rothschilds ended up winning. And according to Wharton, why? How? Since Achille Fould and Perret were using the same strategies, what were they missing? And his thesis is that they had no heirs. They had no sons. They thought that they could just do all of this in their generation, in their time, and they could beat the Rothschilds at their own game. They came really close. In a couple of cases, they did, but they didn't win out long-term because they didn't have any sons. They were committed to an ideology, but they didn't have any biology. So the Rothschilds ended up winning also this battle, and eventually Credit Mobilier collapsed. They were eventually able also to buy off, in many cases, state protection for certain situations. So, for example, at one point, there were some spies who were able to crack their code system, and they were getting some of the advanced Rothschild intelligence. And the Rothschilds then decided to pay off the heads of state to protect the Rothschild mail system with state protection. And so pretty much at any point, they could pay it off. If a head of state went against the Rothschilds, according to Morton, all the Rothschilds had to do was leak fake intelligence that plots were being hatched of revolutionaries and leftists. And perhaps maybe there were plots, but all they could fund those things if they were, they had all the money in the world. But even if they didn't want to fund it, they could just leak disinformation. And the disinformation was destabilizing enough that it could bring those errant heads of state back into line. So eventually, by the mid to late 1800s, there were no significant challengers anymore to the Rothschilds, and they were the preeminent worldwide gold credit system establishers for the entire world. They represent the replacement of the feudal world with the capitalist lords. Lords in the sense of like banking lords. Throughout all this time, it's also amazing they kept their holdings secret. Nobody knew exactly how much they had. Any of their opponents were never able to overtake them. They made vast loans to throughout the world. So this became an international global empire to the extent that even when people would try to oppose them, they also realized that they needed state power. So one of the reasons that Lord Rothschild in England went into the House of Lords was because he realized that, yeah, we can buy off people, but it might be a little easier if we actually just have state power. The book argues as well that Disraeli was, although verbally a Christian, he always considered himself a Marranos, which is a false convert. When the Spanish tried to force Jews to become converts to Catholicism, these were known as the Marranos, and the Marranos would say they were Catholic, but were actually just still Jewish. Allegedly, Disraeli himself maintained this exact same position. Now, the most fascinating aspect of this book, and if you go to my channel, we're going to get into the rest of this in the next few days on my YouTube channel. Be sure and follow me because we cover stuff no one else covers, these types of big books. I knew about Warburg and Rockefeller support for Lenin. I did not know that the Rothschilds also sent 1 million rubles to Vladimir Lenin to help with his, quote, revolution. So yes, Lord Rothschild 100% was behind Lenin. Says on page 191 that Lord Rothschild in England sent 1 million rubles to Vladimir Lenin, P.I. Lenin, to be successful in his revolution. There was an expectation that Lenin would pay this back. Lenin never paid it back. So Lenin out-Leninned the Rothschilds, never paid them back for this loan. But it ended up being successful because, of course, the Bolsheviks overthrew the Tsars, and the Rothschilds themselves admitted that they didn't have a lot of respect. In fact, they hated the Orthodox Christians and the Tsars, and they were happy to see them destroyed. So that is the biography of the Rothschilds by Morton. This is the Alex Jones Show. I'm your guest host, Jay Dyer of Jay's Analysis.
Have you noticed all the big universities and corporate media and governments around the world run down America all day? That's because the American system stands against their globalist system. And as the public figures that out, their corrupt, tyrannical, oppressive, communistic, anti-human death cult can't compete with what America stands for. And we stand in the shoes, on the shoulders of our forebears. Whether you're black, white, Hispanic, old, young, if you love liberty and freedom, and if you want to be free, and if you want to control your own destiny, you believe in meritocracy, then America is for you. It's under attack because the idea of it stands in the way of the enemy. And America is a dream, just like a dream to get married, or a dream to start a business, or a dream to write a poem or write a song. And when you do that, those dreams come true. But we have to breathe life into those dreams. They want to kill those dreams. Don't let them break your will. Be proud to be an American and know people around the world still love America and understand it's the globalists that have hijacked us, and we're in the process of taking our country back from the Chi-Coms and the Israel lobby and the globalists and Hollywood and the left and all of them. And that's why it's so important to support the next leg in the info war at alexjoneslive.com. And, of course, at thealexjonesstore.com with the widest selection of Patriot apparel, the best supplements, collectible knives, the best water filtration, and more that will empower and enrich your life while keeping this beacon of truth on the air as we accelerate into the future and as the Great Awakening prepares the final defeats of the globalists and their Great Reset. I salute you all. This is 1776 2.0. We're unstoppable together. God bless you all.
You do not help fund the resistance. You sit comfortably. You consume. You watch. You wait for others to fight the battle for you. The dark side has you firmly in its grasp. Every day, you remain on the sidelines. My power grows stronger. Continue believing. Someone else will save the galaxy.
Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle, AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.